You're listening to the Podcast Detroit Network. Visit www.podcastdetroit.com for more information.
You're listening to What Won't We Say?
We believe that we are better in community and that all people want to be known.
That true authenticity can only be reached through honesty and vulnerability.
This is a judgment-free zone and a shame-free space where individuality is encouraged and celebrated.
We are your hosts, Sonia Mastic
and Jen Kinney.
All right, so tonight we're going to take a little different approach. This podcast will come out probably a few weeks from when we're recording it, but currently we are in the day after Christmas slumber of... I joked that I worked out earlier and I got the cheese sweats, which I'm pretty sure that's what that sweat was.
Yeah, I have just the cheese sweats. I need to try to actually, you know, go and exercise.
just existing.
But can I just tell you, like, I started Christmas from before Thanksgiving. And I thought, this year I'm going to celebrate the holiday even though I don't want to.
Yeah.
I put up 3 Christmas trees. I'm making the best of it. And I'm not kidding. Yesterday around 5 p.m., I was done with Christmas and I was like, oh my gosh, I had no idea the weight that was on my shoulders or my back or whatever, my entire body. Over the holidays, like I had no idea how
stressful
it was.
To put on a nice holiday, like to make it perfect.
I don't even know, because honestly, I think I did a really good job of not getting all caught up. We didn't have a lot of family obligations. I hosted my parents. I didn't even make green bean casserole this year.
Wow,
you know, it was just like a ham showed up. We heated up some pierogies in a pan. Like,
I'm sorry, can you say that again?
Yeah, it was really low key. No
pierogies.
Pierogies. I'm Polish, you know, so on Christmas Eve,
I know.
That's what we would typically
But you actually said it correctly, too, so.
I know.
You got all Alex Trebek on it. Got fancy.
Yeah, I can be annoying. Yeah. So anyway, I had no idea how stressful the holidays were to me until they were done, and I was like, hell yes, I'm ready for New Year's Day. Like, I want everything behind me. I want the clean start to the new year, even though I know it's just, you know, this idea, and it's not an actual new start, but like, I'm done.
I am already the person that the day after Christmas, I'm already strategizing for when all the decorations come down.
Yeah.
And it's supposed to be 50-something this Friday. Mm-hmm. It only rained in the morning. So before I left here to come record, I was already telling my husband, I'm like, okay, so I'm just going to do the outside decorations by myself because it'll be warm enough and I'm just going to get them down.
Well, and you guys are hardcore. You really decorate your outside,
yeah,
which is awesome.
So we do leave some clear lights up until the spring because we actually have lights outside in the summer. We have hanging porch lights and stuff just to make it a little festive.
But, very nice.
But as I was launching in the beginning, I said this is going to be a slightly different approach. It's just Jen and I tonight, and we thought we would sort of maybe interview each other a little bit so the listener can get to know us a little.
Yeah.
So as Jen and I are getting to know each other, we're starting to realize a lot of similarities, even realizing we've worked some places together around the same time when we were much younger.
Mm-hmm.
And this is really interesting. So where are you from?
I am from Ortonville, Michigan, also known lovingly as Ortontucky.
So a big, giant town.
Big, giant town. Yep. We had our first grocery store maybe 10 years into me living there. Otherwise, before that, we were driving an hour to get to a grocery store.
An hour?
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Where did you live? I mean, so far out.
Well, it would be like an hour round trip, maybe a little more round trip.
Got it. Okay. That
because
makes sense.
I think there was like some Kroger somewhere in Clarkston or, you know, who knows. But there were no hospitals around. So like my brother was stung by bees and he was allergic and we didn't know. And he almost died when he was like 3 years old.
Wow.
No ambulance. Had to drive like 40 minutes to Wheelock Hospital.
Mm.
Crazy.
I have some more abstract questions to ask you.
Ooh.
Because, I mean, you know, like,
I'm excited.
We can unload the where are you from? What do you do? Whatever.
What's your favorite color?
What's your favorite food? Cheese is the answer before I even say it. So more abstractly, what would you say is one of the defining moments of darkness that has shaped you in your life?
Wow. See, there was no preparation in this.
I know.
A defining moment of darkness in my life. Hmm. I'd have to choose because I have a number of
them. We all
them.
Do, but yeah, one, I mean, it doesn't have to be like the one, but like, you know, everyone has some that sort of changed, shaped you in some way for the rest of your life.
Honestly, I would say, and maybe it's because it's the most recent in my mind, is having, after I had twins, for those of you who don't know, and I had really severe postpartum depression. Wow. And I didn't even realize it. We lived in China at the time. I lived like 12 floors up. And I remember imagining tossing myself over the balcony.
Wow.
And just thinking like the kids would be better without me and everybody would be better without me. And the fact that I got through that time without really even understanding that or acknowledging it, but looking back in hindsight going, oh, that wasn't normal.
Right.
You know, I would say the darkness that kind of followed that, because that had a lot of very heavy consequences for my marriage. Mm. Because for a couple of years, I was checked out and my husband was like on it constantly.
Right.
And after a while, the person who's on it constantly and taking care of everything and dealing with this stuff, there's going to be some resentment that builds and some challenges. So I would say for me, like, faith, identity, marriage, identity, like huge, huge, huge impact on those things. And there just came this point of breakthrough for me where I realized that and just taking those lessons into life and into marriage. And I would say that was probably my most significant point of darkness that, you know, emerging from it, I've taken a lot from it, but it wasn't like a quick emergence. It was
right.
over years.
And so, was the emergence, did you end up getting help with it? Did you not know what it was until later?
I didn't. Yeah. Which is insane. And two, I was living in China, so I was really isolated.
Sure.
I have, my mother-in-law's a trained therapist. My mother is a midwife, you know, like she would have been on the lookout for that because they lost patients and friends and, so she had always talked to me about that. But even with all that background and training, you know, it's kind of like you're stuck on this island in the middle of literally China with no friends or family that are really, really close to you. And it's easy to get isolated.
Sure.
So yeah.
Well, okay. So then the opposite side is what's one of the greatest, like, lightest moments in your life that has shaped you?
So that came when we actually lived in China the first time, and then like for like almost 5 years, and we got this crazy experience where we got to go back. We were supposed to go for 3 years. And I remember when we decided to go back, I remember thinking all of the things that I didn't do the first time I was there. You know, I try not to get stuck in regrets because there's no point in it. But this time I got to sit and think, okay, what do I regret not doing? What do I wish I had done differently? And so, like, the first time I lived there, I wouldn't even get on a bicycle. And if you've been in Asia, anywhere, like Vietnam, Thailand, China, like, you see these videos of people on bicycles. It's chaos that you can't even fathom here in the West. But I wouldn't get on a bicycle. I remember finding out Phil got on a bicycle, and I was really pissed at him because I'm like, you're going to die. You know, and I was, like, very scared of a lot of things. Even though I was very adventurous, I was probably more on the small end there.
Yeah, that's surprising for me to hear you say, too, that you were afraid of that because you are so adventurous.
Yeah, so when we went back, I didn't just get on a bicycle. I bought a scooter.
I remember this.
And that scooter, I didn't just buy a scooter. I endangered my children and put them on it with me. And for those
with
of you
groceries.
Who don't know me, I'm like maybe 5'1". And so if you can imagine me driving this scooter, like Vespa thing with two children, it was a sight to behold. I mean, yeah, I wouldn't recommend it. But I was taking it and I was going. So I just started doing. And then I started working for an anti-trafficking organization over there. And then I started writing. And I started. So I had this moment where I read a book by Brené Brown. Damn it, Brené.
I know.
You know,
she's ruined and improved my life.
Right, exactly. It's like I love her and I hate her, but I read The Gifts of Imperfection.
Mm.
And it was life-changing. And I was at this point where I had started writing more and doing something I haven't done in a while.
Blogging, journaling?
No, freelance work. So I had started doing some freelance work. And I wrote this one piece and it was absolutely well-received. published. I got a lot of feedback, and I couldn't write anything after that for like 8 months.
Yeah, it's the worst.
And I was like, what is going on here? So when I read Gifts of Imperfection, I realized like I was totally stuck in this place where I wanted to recapture, and I felt this weight that I had to perform perfectly or do the same mm-hmm. over and over again. But what I sat and I wrote was an article about what it's like being a mother of a child with epilepsy.
Okay.
And it was just a very raw, vulnerable sharing of what it's like to have that child go to bed every night and not really know if they're going to wake up in the morning.
Yeah, wow.
You know, so it was like, it was just this moment of vulnerability and honesty. And I think that, you know, mixed with the fact that it got published and received well, just the pressure for me was too much. So when I read The Gifts of Imperfection, I mean, I just remember having this awakening on an entirely new level. I started writing more, putting myself out there, working for Eden Ministry, you know, doing everything that I wanted to do and doing it unapologetically. So that was my big breakthrough.
That's amazing. Well, and for the record, you had told me about The Gift of Imperfection, and I bought that for – I haven't read it yet myself. I'm like 8 books in the hole right now, and a lot of them are books I actually need to read.
Oh, yeah.
And so – but I gave them to a few people for Christmas, and I gave them early, and everybody hates me now.
That's awesome.
Everyone's like, this book's just rocking me, including my husband, who doesn't really read a lot of books cover to cover, and he's read the whole thing, and he's just like, oh, my God, this is so much to unpack.
Yeah, I had my husband read it, too.
Yeah, it's next to my roster. So you mentioned the second time you went to China is when you got involved with Eden Ministries.
Yes.
So talk a little bit about that.
So Eden is an anti-trafficking organization in Asia. They're actually in Myanmar. And I had been working in, and by working in, I mean on the periphery, doing writing for bringing awareness to human trafficking for a good decade. And the cool thing is, as I got involved in it, we were really on the cusp worldwide, but particularly in the United States, of awareness and learning. You know, because you feel like when you start telling people about something like this, you feel like you're hitting your head against the wall in a lot of ways. Because for years and years and years, I was aware of and speaking up about the horrors of human trafficking, mm-hmm. the prevalence of it, the fact that we were seeing an increase in trafficking worldwide, which was just, it didn't make sense in the beginning. Now we have a greater understanding as to why. So when I was living in the States, I was writing for and in kind of lifting my voice to shine a light on this organization and what they were doing and try to bring people in to support them. So when I moved to Asia, I was able to work more closely with them. And that was just an amazing opportunity to be able to see almost firsthand the effects of trafficking, to connect with an organization that was seeking to not only bring awareness to the plight of trafficking, but also to make changes mm-hmm. and to stop it.
Yeah, eradicate.
And so they would reach out to, and they still do, and they're actually growing, which is awesome. They reach out to the red light districts. They build relationships with the women, with the pimps, with the brothel owners. And they do a variety of different things. They'll go out in Myanmar and they will take a van and they'll do mobile HIV testing. So every single week they go out and they do this. Now, a lot of pimps and brothel owners, as you can imagine, are really, really clamped down on their girls and women because they don't want them to get away. But because they understand the dollars behind, you know, well, if you have a girl who's infecting people, you know, it's good to actually learn about and get tested and see if they're HIV positive, they will allow them into the van. So you've got like 10 minutes. But in that 10 minutes, we're able to connect with them, give them information on local sites that they can go to. We'll even host a variety of different classes so that it's like, oh, well, you know, come on, you can learn hair braiding or you can learn this. And so we even have some brothel owners bringing their girls to these programs. And then through that and through developing these relationships, you get to connect with them. And then eventually a lot of these women we end up seeing coming in the doors. and saying, I want out, I need out, but I don't know how, and now I know I can get help. So can you help me, please? And so then we're able to help them, put them into housing, get them education, skills, training, all of these different things. And for a very long time, the model that we used was jewelry making.
Mm-hmm.
And then we would sell the jewelry, and 100% of the proceeds would go back into the facilities. We're shifting that and changing that depending on the areas that they're in now, just because markets are changing and people's desires are changing. And a lot of the women at this point want to learn a skill that they can take home to their hometown. Mm-hmm. So, you know, hair, makeup, nails, whatever. So that is Eden and how I got into it in a nutshell.
So I guess the next question then is, there's a million causes you could be aligning yourself to and helping with. What personally spoke to you about getting involved with that? Because it's such a, not that any sort of work like that is glamorous, but it's such a like hard kind of soul sucking, you know, it has to be like being a woman watching women being exploited has to be gut wrenching. That's a much better word I want to use. So what made you get involved and drew you to it to the point that you're still involved to this day?
I honestly can't tell you. Mm. Like, I don't really know. And it was such a part of my advocacy for so long that I don't really remember. You know, it was probably 12 to 15 years ago when I really started advocating and learning about it. And there are so many things, like you said, that you read about, you hear about, and some things just stick. Some things just get you more than others. There are a lot of different things that I care about, but yeah, I don't feel called specifically into lending my time, my voice, my energy, you know, my blood, sweat, and tears to. So for me, you know, human trafficking and anti-trafficking work has been that for quite some time.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
Well, okay. So I think we'll open up the floor to you now. Do you want to turn the tables here and ask me some questions? And
yeah. So tell me a little bit about you. I am curious because, you know, you are.
I'm a Taurus. I like long walks on the beach. All right. Those are both true statements, actually, even though I say that always joking.
You're a Taurus and you like long walks on the beach.
It's true.
I haven't seen a beach in a really long time.
I have, not that long ago, but it was very cold.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit about you, where you came from, what has brought you to where you are today.
Well, I came also from a small town, from Waterford, Michigan. Waterford Township, no less.
And, I know it well.
Yeah, and it is exactly how it sounds. It's full of water. There's lakes everywhere. So even though it's not a massively large town, it takes you forever to get anywhere because you have to drive around a freaking lake. And they're not like little like man-made lakes. They're like giant lakes. So I grew up in Waterford, and I live in Ferndale now. I moved in my like mid-20s out of Waterford, and I moved to Royal Oak first, actually, and then to Ferndale. But so yeah, that's sort of where I'm from. The majority of my husband is from there too. We actually met there, but not until we were adults, not until later. But we had the same circle of friends, and it took us, you know, 10 years of the same circle of friends before we finally met each other, which is extremely strange in such a small town. But
right.
Most of his family still lives there. Some of my family, like aunts and uncles, live there, but my immediate family are kind of out from there. But that's where I'm from.
Okay, so that's where you're from. I hesitate to ask you the questions you ask me because you were creative enough to think of those questions.
And you're going to have to come up with your own, Jen. I'm sorry.
I know. I don't want to take you there. Tell me about your darkest moment. No. Yeah. What I'm curious about is just from a music standpoint.
Okay.
You are a drummer.
Yep.
And you have been a drummer since when? When did you get started?
So I started playing guitar first when I was about 5. And I'm not really a very skilled guitarist, and I'm not saying that humbly. I'm not like, you know, the humble brag, like, I'm not that great, and I'm a virtuoso. No, I stink. But I'm a good drummer. And so I started playing drums when I was about 19, I think, 18, 19.
Really?
Yeah, I didn't tell I was older.
Interesting.
And I did it originally to spite the guy I just broke up with who was a drummer.
Really?
Yeah. So I actually learned and had a successful career with an instrument that I learned how to spite.
That's amazing. Yeah. Because so often, like when you meet people who are really well-established musicians, you imagine that, or at least I imagine, I should use the first person.
Yeah.
I imagine that, you know, they're a prodigy that started playing when they were 5 years old.
I started playing instruments and I always had a strong interest. So I played the guitar and like I dabbled in like guitar and bass and other things when I was young. And but I didn't really get serious. But it's just funny that that is sort of what prompted me to start playing drums. But then that was the instrument, like that was lightning in a bottle.
Can I confess, I actually started cooking and baking after a breakup to spite a person as well.
I'm telling you, spite talents are...
And I'm telling you, I can bake.
Yeah, you can bake, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I started doing that, but then, yeah, it was lightning in a bottle, and I completely identified with it. And then I luckily had a decent acumen. Like, it just sort of became very... I did work hard at it, To coin the phrase of our previous guest Raylan, I humbly worked very hard at it, but I also had a really natural aptitude for it. So, and that just sort of took off from there.
Yeah. So you were in a band. At what age did you start really getting heavily involved with other musicians?
20, like right away.
Wow.
Yeah, right away. Because everybody sucks in the beginning, so you can just find other people that suck and get a band with them, you know? And you sort of work your way through bands. And I only played in bands through my 20s and maybe early 30s. And then after that, I've just been for hire.
Yeah. So did you have one band in particular that you really played with and... did a lot with?
I have several. The last one, which was a long time ago, I mean, I haven't played in a band situation in a while, but the last one that was definitely the most fun and the most recognizable here is Sister Otis and the Holy Rollers.
Mm-hmm.
And so won a lot of music awards and Detroit Music Awards, and we headlined the music awards, and we did a lot of great stuff and a lot of touring and college towns, and it was a lot of fun.
Do you miss touring?
I don't. I it is for some people. It's not for me.
Yeah.
It was for me for a long time. I worked for Live Nation for a long time. And I did work locally a lot, but I also traveled a lot for it. And then between all of that, I ended up, when I left Live Nation, I worked for a booking agency. And I had to travel a lot for that. We booked bands around the world. And it just got exhausting traveling all the time. And so I have a lot of experiences that most people won't have their entire lifetime, like you traveling and living, you know, abroad and everything.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't miss touring at all. It's hard. And people tend to fantasize that it's this party all day. And it can be, I guess, if you're really famous. But if you're at the level that we were, you drive all day. And then you try to rush into the town to set up, do sound check. And then if you're lucky, you get to work further by going into a radio station and doing interviews, or you do like an in-store at that time that Borders were still around. So Borders bookstores would hire people. Yeah. And so you go in and do like an acoustic set or something like that, because you're just trying to generate as much revenue and get in front of as many people as you can in each town. So you would do like a radio spot and then like a in-store if you could, and then you would do your show, and then you would pack up, and then you would try to drive halfway, stay at a hotel for 4 or 5 hours sometimes, and then you just get back in the van and you go to the next town and you do that. And you do that. So just eat like garbage. It's not glamorous. It's very hard work. And that's what always irks me when people call musicians lazy. I'm like, oh my God. You knew the amount of work that went in, and usually you have day jobs on top of it.
Right.
So you're just like working like 80, 90, 100 hours a week just to have a, kind of a remotely fruitful career in music while still trying to eat and pay a mortgage, trying to adult in some way, you know?
Yeah. But it sounds like for you, it is a passion.
It is. And that's the kick in the ass about it, is that you can't not do it. It becomes who you are. I mean, it is definitely part of, it's not only just a part of my identity, it's a part of my DNA. And so if I spend too, even if I force myself to spend time away from it, I end up just writing stuff, working on stuff, and then somebody will call me to record on something, and I'm like, yeah, I'll do it, you know? And, but it's afforded really good opportunities. And, but yeah, my passion definitely more lies in recording than it does live.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there comes a time in your life, I shouldn't speak for anyone else, But for myself, there's a time where my ego just didn't need it anymore.
Mm.
And it wasn't a conversation anymore. It was me on stage, and I wasn't conversing with the audience anymore with what I was doing. So I think that's the turning point when you stop playing live, probably, is when...
That's interesting.
Because it really should be viewed as a dialogue mm-hmm. with the audience. And that's why when you see movies like High Fidelity mm-hmm. and he's making the perfect playlist, he's like, you got to start up high, but then you cool it down. Right. You don't want to give it all away all at once. You know, you cool it down by the third song. And then, you know, and that's literally how musicians put together a set list. Like, what's right. going to get people amped up and kind of out of their seat and excited. And you get your second one, you heighten it more. And then you cool it down a little because you don't want everyone to get too wore out and sick of listening to you by the fourth song. So it's just, you know, there is a science to it.
Yeah, there is a lot to unpack here. So definitely in future shows, we will talk more about this because you have a lot of fantastic stories. But I want to talk more about you and kind of what makes you tick. So when you stopped feeling like you were able to converse, you stepped out of it, but you still really feel this need to play.
Mm-hmm.
And so you do studio work.
I do.
And more recently, you've done some recording. And actually, the music at the front of our show and at the end of our show is actually some of your mm-hmm. your music.
Yep, that was my original band.
Tell me about this. What have you been doing recently?
So recently, I have done different work here and there, but the last bit of stuff that I did was for this local band called Tiles, and they are just fantastic group of guys and really, really good musicians, and they put together the craziest ensembles for their records. They get these amazing. So they had like Ian Anderson from Jethro Tull on it, and
wow.
Just I could go on and on about the, you know, like guys from Dream Theater Mike Portnoy, who used to be in Dream Theater. He's not anymore, but
right.
Yeah, him and his son and, Mike Stern, the jazz guitarist. I mean, you go on and on of all the people that were on there and Terry Brown, who produced all the best Rush records, in my opinion. He was the producer on that record, and I worked with Terry with Tiles two different times now, once in Toronto and for a couple releases ago of theirs, and then once for their new release. And so the new release is called Pretending to Run, and that's so I'm on that.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
But you've done some of your own solo work.
So the music that's in the beginning of this is mine, mm-hmm. And it is, that was from years ago. I put together a jazz improv band.
Oh, okay.
So literally never rehearsed together, never got in a room together. Everything we did right on the spot, right on stage.
And what was that like? How do you choose people for that?
You pick people that are super ballsy, you know, that are courageous and kind of stupid. No.
You know a few of those people.
I'm saying, you have to be kind of crazy to do
right.
it. And you just have to be confident. I mean, jokes aside, you have to be adventurous and confident. And so I would basically lead it like a band leader, where I would just point to one of the musicians and they would just start. We have no idea what they were going to play to start with. And then everybody just starts falling in line and filling in. And we did that. The recording that is at the beginning of the podcast is from Memphis Smoke, which obviously isn't there anymore, but it was in Memphis Smoke and Royal Oak, and we did it live. And
that is so cool. So, what was that like? Was it really different from anything you'd done before?
Yeah, it was really liberating because, you know, there's the joke. This is once is a mistake and twice is jazz.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, you make the mistake two times and it's jazz. So it was a lot like that. Like, I was confident in all the players and I was confident in myself. So which you don't get to hear is we only have an instrumental part, but our singer was technically not a singer, but a poet. So it was a Matthew Olsman, who's one of my very favorite poets of all time, of anybody. He now no longer lives in Michigan, he and his wife, Vivi, but he's incredible. And so he did all of his like spoken word poems over top of it. It was like way hipster before hipster.
Wow.
But I enjoyed it. I just invited all these people and I thought they would be like, you're crazy. And everybody that I didn't have to ask any, I didn't have to go down from like, you know, I didn't have to ask the second string. I didn't have to ask like, you know, the second bass player that I had in mind. All the first that I had in mind were like, yeah, okay, what time? Just tell us, you know, pay us and we'll be there. Yeah.
That is awesome. That's really cool. Now, your husband is a musician, yes?
Yep.
Okay. Do you guys ever work together?
We did in bands on rare occasions, but we tried not to work together too much because, you know, you're together all the time.
Right. Yeah. It's kind of like in business, this would be business. It would be. Drive each other crazy.
Yeah, and just, so we did, and we do now, we write songs together, so some of the solo stuff that I just put out recently, I'm actually, I do play drums on it, but I actually play ukulele and guitar on a lot of it.
Wow.
And so the new project that I have is called Sowns, it's S-O-W-N-S, and it's a nickname given to me by Neil Diamond. That's a long story right there.
So that'll be next time at another time.
So called me Sones a lot. So that project, he actually plays on that with me, and he produced it and engineered it and everything. So
very cool. So what are you looking forward to in the new year?
This. I'm really enjoying the podcast. Mm-hmm. And you know, I got some pieces published this year through the Mighty and through some other places, you know, some of my writing. So more writing. I put my office space in the She Hive, and I'm a key holder there. So I'm looking forward to a lot of the workshops and things that are unfolding there that, you know, hopefully get to be a part of.
And what are you feeling or sensing about the She Hive at this point? Because it seems to me, I mean, we interviewed Ursula Adams in a previous podcast, and just hearing about what they're doing is so amazing. This entire focus on, you know, cultivating authenticity and doing and being who you want to be, and particularly as women, that is something that I find very, very encouraging and also liberating to see organizations like this popping up. And then, too, to our podcast, you know, basically, for those of you, if you're just listening to this one, the reason we started this podcast, other than the fact that we like an excuse to get together and eat cheese and drink wine and, you know, talk shit, is this realization that we have a lot of women around us who are amazing, badass women who do the most amazing things. And we're not necessarily like special people in that regard. So what has it been like being at the She Hive and kind of stepping into this space where you are like stepping into the space and doing what you feel like you want to do in life?
Well, so the interesting spin on the She Hive that makes it different than other sort of women's empowerment, I'm doing the air quotes right now, the women's empowerment sort of organizations and things that I've been with is that for me, the difference has been that Ursula really drives home integrity and character. So all of these things of allowing the space for women to be their best, to be their most productive selves and to unfold ideas and ingenuity and things is all completely lost if there's not character behind the treatment of each other. Mm-hmm. And so that's what is so unique about it is that it's not just preferred, it's insisted upon. And so they have, you know, we read them in the podcast with Ursula, you know, like, and you can't, you know, don't talk about, you talk people up, you don't talk people down. Mm-hmm. You don't talk about people when they're not there, things like that. And it's not like, we prefer that you didn't do that. It's the, you'll in a lovingly way be confronted if it happens. And so I enjoy that aspect because there's no point in having spaces like that if you're not going to teach people how to treat people.
Well, that seems key. It's not just, you know, like the corporate idea of, oh, we're going to seek diversity and put
where it stops, though.
Right, exactly. Yeah. It's like this sounds like this is going deeper.
It's going much deeper. And so it's cultivating relationships. It's a lot of ownership when you screw up. And I've seen Ursula screw up big and apologize and then out herself in front of the whole key holders thing saying, I did this to this person and point the person out at the table and say, this is how we resolved it.
Oh, wow.
Right. Big, big ovaries on that woman. And so, wow. So that's what I mean. Like it is really in a very good, loving way, a put up or shut up kind of place. Like, so it does kind of wash some people out immediately.
That's awesome.
And then it retains the people that want to come in and do the hard work.
Right.
Because we're all flawed and we all do stupid things and say stupid things. But to have a place that will give you the flexibility and grace to get through it, but to still hold you accountable to that, that's the difference for me. And so it fosters a real genuine space. And that's super rare. And it's very it's hard to come up with words, but it's like, it's very, right. it's very inclusive, but it's very nurturing. So it's not just lip service. If you come in and you get involved with them and they say, we want to make your business better. Mm-hmm. I get key networking through them. They like, you can reach out to any of those women on there and they put their money where their mouth is. And they will, if you say, I have an ask and I need this, this, and this, people will do everything they can to get you what you need.
Wow. That's awesome.
Yeah, without hesitation. It's just like, that's just what we're here for. We're here to help each other out.
Mm, that's very cool.
You want to join now, don't you?
I do. I've thought about it.
You'd be awesome. You'd fit right in.
But what would I do? I mean, obviously, I'd edit this out. We can talk about it later.
But... No, I don't think we should. But yeah, I mean, you should come around. I'll give you a tour. No.
Right?
As if you haven't been there a million times.
I didn't even really know what they did until we interviewed her. I thought it was just a shared workspace. And then I'm like, oh, there's so much more to
this
place than
I realized. Yeah, lots of classes and all that. Yeah.
Yeah. And so I followed them on Facebook and they post these things. I'm like, ooh, I want to go to the dream board class.
That's Man, that sold out so fast. I was bummed. I wanted to do it too. The vision board.
Oh, it
board,
sold
yeah,
out? Uh-oh.
In like 4.2 seconds. They'll do a bunch of other ones, but I'm sure someone will do another one. But
well,
yeah.
We'll have to do our own dream That's right. board. Dream boards with cheese.
I think mine will be a nightmare board.
No, you're going to read Brené Brown's book soon.
Yeah.
So, okay. So you have 8 books on your stack.
Yeah.
So do you read physical books or do you do audiobooks?
I have to do physical books. Mm. I try so hard to do... I can't even freaking do the tablet books.
Oh, I hate tablet books.
I hate them so much. And so I don't... Audiobooks are... I can do audiobooks if they're like things I need for work or something like that. But I need to form my own inflection and my own narrative if it's fiction. Mm. I don't want somebody doing that with their voice.
That is interesting. I am analyzing you right now.
I don't want them to mess up my journey in my head.
Wow.
And so that's why I don't like it. I like my own inflection. The only books that I like to read to me and I prefer now is David Sedaris.
Oh, interesting.
I've listened to every book he's ever written on audio because he is hilarious. His voice is hilarious.
Yeah.
And because they're his stories.
Right.
I want the inflection. Right. I want him to do it. But if it's someone else's, if it's a fiction story and I was in some book clubs and I did a few of them on audio because I was just trying to cheat and get him in it the last 2 days before I had to go to the meeting.
Oh, yeah.
And I hated it.
That's how I discovered audiobooks. I was hosting a Food for Thought event. Where instead of like just getting together for dinner and talking about a topic, we were going to take a book on because it was after Trump was elected. And I think everybody just felt so gutted and unsafe that somebody recommended doing a book reading. And I thought, okay, that's easy. 2 days before, I remember like walking around the house frantically, cleaning, doing, whatever, and listening. And then I realized that audiobooks were the opening for me into reading again and using my brain.
So you love them?
I love them for what they provide right now. But my problem is I don't retain anything.
But that's what I mean about creating. So if you could read them and create your own reality, you would retain it.
Yes.
Because your brain works in a different way to actually manufacture that reality.
Yes.
I remember work ones because they're tangible, useful bits of information that immediately I can process into my head how to use it, how it's applicable. Mm-hmm. And then that's why I can retain it. But I can't retain, I cannot retain fiction or enjoyment. Or my mind just drifts into something else.
Yeah, I'm at that point in life where I'm just trying to take what I can and make the most of what I have. And with 2 kids at home and homeschooling them and being really busy and, doing all of the things, mm-hmm. I'm like, okay, well, I'd rather at least hear it and whatever I can take from it, great. Maybe I need to re-listen. But there are times where I'll listen to even like a podcast. And I listened to it again accidentally, and I'm like halfway through, and I'm like, oh, wow, I think I listened to this just last week. That's not good. So, I mean, it is what it is. One day, I still collect the books. I've got like this beautiful pile by my bedside, and I like to take pictures of it and put it on Instagram on occasion and make myself look really, intelligent and well-read, but it's a lie. I'm well listened.
It's still well read. You're still retaining some of the info.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's funny too, because I do have in my list of things that I have to finish another Brené Brown book.
Yeah.
So it's The Dare to Lead.
Yeah.
So I have that book Fed Up.
I haven't Yeah, I saw that.
That's on my list, yeah.
So Sarah Zimmerman had that on, we had on the podcast earlier. She had that on her like book club.
Coincidentally, yeah. I bought the book like 3 months ago and I just haven't had any time because I'm reading Donald Miller's A Story Brand as well, which is about marketing. So I have a lot of marketing books for my business because I own a social media marketing company.
Yeah.
Rise Above the Din. So yeah, I have to, it's an ever-changing landscape. So you constantly have to learn about marketing.
Yeah, well, in doing the anti-racism podcast, like I've got a pile of books that are all nonfiction.
Yeah.
Insanely heavy.
I was going to say that's got to be hard to digest.
It is challenging. And I just started listening to a book by the author, but it is incredibly difficult. So I take it in small chunks and then, you know.
Oh, I've been reading.
Have a breakdown. So
that's a good question then. I've been reading Richard Rohr's Falling Upward for 3 years. I'm not kidding. Because I can only unpack it.
Uh-huh.
And these small, so I can read 5 books at a time in a month. But this book has challenged me to my core that I can only, and I unpack it sometimes and read like a few more pages when I'm on the treadmill or something. And then I'm like, it's just too much. So is there any books that have taken you recently a really long time to get through because they were so, to pardon the impression, so in the impression, toothy? They were so much to get through.
Many. I have several like that.
Are they all the anti-racism?
Most of them, yes. They all have something to do with deconstruction.
Right.
And
very, very, very astute. I didn't think about that.
Yeah. And so initially being a semi-wannabe perfectionist, you know, I always felt like this failure because this book is unfinished and it's, you know, on my shoulder until I can finish it.
Even if you hate it.
Yeah. But I've come to learn like, okay, if this is a book that I want to continue reading and I can't get to it right now, it's okay. I'm going to take it in bits and pieces and just trust that. You know, what I read when I read it is when I'm supposed to read
it. It's healthy.
Yeah.
So. And that's why but also the Richard Rohr book is on a tablet.
Yeah.
It's making it worse. I'm trying really hard to finish this book, but it's on a tablet. And
so we're going to plug a place that doesn't even put money in our pockets here, but there's an app I found that's amazing. It's called Scribd or Scribd.
Oh, I guess someone else just gave me this too.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. It's amazing because pretty much every book I've looked for with the exception of Harry Potter is on there and most of them are audio. And it's like $9 a month. And since I'm doing audiobooks, what I do now is I listen and if I like the book, I buy it in the hardcover and then I can go back through and read it and take it in or whatever. So you might want to look up, that book and give it a listen.
So I have some traditions for Christmas, sort of shifting gears here. And one of them is I spend Christmas night. So Christmas Day, we always have the wanderers, the vagabonds at our house. So it's like the people that have nowhere to go usually come over and we just eat pie and drink and watch TV. And
awesome.
We have a fire going. But I like to watch all of the like SNL Christmas things.
Oh.
So I like the, you know, like the Justin Timberlake Dick in a Box. And, but my favorite one is all the NPR ones. And so one's the Pete Schwede, the Schwede balls.
Mm-hmm.
But I love like, cause I knew we were doing a podcast today and I'm cracking up thinking of, thank you. Welcome for coming. Thank you. Thank you for coming and listening to us on NPR today. Jen Kenny is here. I was thinking of like, you know, literally I don't leave treats out for Santa because I have a rat problem. You know, just the right up on the microphone, super monotone talk, and it made me laugh thinking about it.
That's awesome. We can do the rest of the podcast like that and annoy people.
Just straight up on the microphone. Except I sound a little more like a female Barry White than and you're woo, 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 woo. I know it's not Barry White. No one give me crap. I know who it is. It's Jeffrey Osborne. Calm down. I suddenly couldn't think of a Barry White song. I've panicked.
Yeah, I found myself on Christmas Eve watching like the best of 2018 Fallon stuff and just looking for a comedic relief in a sense.
Yes.
And it was so fantastic. Laughter is so good.
I love though, like it's like it's not the crude content of the Justin Timberlake Dick in a Box. Like I think that's funny because I'm a 12-year-old boy as far as humor goes. But I love the fact that they recreated 80s R&B so perfectly with like the eyeliner beard around the that sculpts over the chin and the like shiny shirts and the oh my gosh.
Actually, I think I ended up watching the Fallon thing because of something you initially shared on Facebook.
I think it was the Shreddy.
Yeah, and then it was the Christmas song with Ariana Grande.
Yeah.
And then that led to me.
Dun, 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 right. Dun, dun, dun.
Yeah. Yeah. So thanks to you, I then looked that up, laughed my ass off, and spilled stuff on my Mac when I was laughing. So
it's all on you, buddy.
Right.
It's all on you. So do you have any. Because I'm with you. When you were talking about Christmas, you know, you were saying you started November or whatever. And I am always the same way. I actually had a really good year this year, but it was purposeful. The same thing. I had to be very purposeful.
Yes.
I don't have any immediate of my own family that I see. So it is a weird time of year of sort of, you're kind of faced with loss of family that you have and
right.
also trying to stay in the moment of all the great things you do have and yada, yada, yada. And it's such a, like, commercialized piece of crap.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, I am as bah humbuggy as they come, unless you get down to the real thing of the holiday.
Mm-hmm.
So I love the, what I love about the holidays, because we also do celebrate Hanukkah and things as well. And what I love about the holidays is what I love about the rest of the year.
Right.
Getting together with friends, eating, drinking,
exactly.
You know, like I love the coming together. I like that the season makes people deliberately try to be in a better mood.
Mm.
I like that aspect of it because I think that's how you get to be in a better mood is you deliberately try to be in a better mood.
Okay. But can I just confess something? I didn't actually post it, but I wanted to one day. I was in Target and I was looking for gifts and I saw these mugs that said, be merry and be bright. And I'm like, don't tell me my business. I don't want to be merry and I don't want to be bright. And I don't need some damn mug that I have to pay for reminding me to do something I don't actually feel like doing.
But
so,
that's the cliche crap, though.
I know. But so I pulled out your good morning asshole mug you got me.
See?
And chuckled. Because that, to me, that just...
Keeping it real.
That's the good stuff.
Keeping it real.
But yeah, no, like the holiday thing, I had a good year. We had a lot of good things happen. And, you know, I'm always trying to be present and focusing on things, you know, that I'm thankful for. But I had a friend this year who lost her husband, lost her child, lost her father-in-law, like tragic stuff.
The same friend?
Yeah, same friend. And
wow.
She has a heart condition where she's had a transplant, is waiting for another transplant.
It's incredible.
And like sometime in November, she started posting that all she wanted for Christmas was to be able to be at home with her kids that day. But she wasn't sure she would make it to that day. And so I was like, you know what? All my bah humbug crap is out the window.
Yeah.
I watched her and she really inspired me to take a hold of things, make it what, you know, was important. And I really have loved like the family and friends and seeing people, and we've been seeing people and it's been really great. But I don't know, it's like the day of for me was just like I made these cookies and I lost my my bonus mom this year to cancer. She had a really long battle with cancer. And she hasn't had a funeral yet, and we're going to do some kind of memorial next year. And so, I mean, even though I was there when she was passing, and even though I know she's gone, there was something about, like, making the cookies and having that day where I was like, oh, my gosh. Like, it just hit me so hard. And so I think part of that, too, was like, I just want to be done with that.
Mm-hmm.
But I haven't had that experience before where on Christmas I'm like, I'm done. I want to put the trees away.
Mm-hmm.
I want to wrap this up. Maybe I celebrated too long. I don't know, but it was challenging this year.
Did you find any portion of making the cookies therapeutic?
I really decorated them. And I decorated them through anxiety over them. You know, I was like, I'm going to make this really pretty, you know, because she would take her frosting and she would do a really nice job of like spreading the frosting on. But I'm like, I'm putting it in a piping bag. I'm taking it up a notch. I'm making little circles and doing little things, you know. And
like somehow you're honoring her with the cookies.
I don't know. I was just like, oh, okay, I'm going to try not to cry.
Phil's
here.
In the corner drinking whiskey, letting you deal with the cookies.
Yeah, yeah. He's like, do you want to go sit and rest? I'm like, leave me alone. These cookies are going to be beautiful.
Get out.
Right? Yeah. No. So, anyway.
So no part of it was therapeutic. It was just...
No, I didn't want to do it.
You felt like you had to do it.
Yeah, like I didn't want to do it. I thought, you know, leaving that space open and empty would be symbolic in itself. But my kids were like, it wouldn't be Christmas without Aunt Clarice's cookies, and we really want them. And, you know, like, so, yeah, I wasn't. I actually didn't want to do them, which is not usual for me. But I sucked it up and I did it. I'm glad I did.
Mm-hmm.
I'm 2 pounds heavier now from, you know, eating half of them.
It looked delicious.
I should have brought those in today, huh? And shared them.
I don't need that with my cheese sweats that I have now.
But anyway. So yeah, so I'm looking forward to the new year, and I'm looking forward to seeing, you know, what's in store for that. And yeah.
Well, that's good. I mean, so anything else you have here?
No, I've got all kinds of crap, but no. We could sing the alphabet. Twinkle, twinkle, little star. No.
So I am curious. I would love for some of the listeners to write in. We have a Facebook page, What Won't We Say? And I'd love for you guys to write in and actually tell us some of your Christmas traditions, things that you like to do on Christmas.
Ooh, that's a good one.
And tell us the ones that you don't like to do that you do anyway, and things that you do like to do. But I think the number one question I have is, what date do you take down your decorations?
Ooh.
It's like such a heated debate. Like, is it like March when it's warm and you still have, you're one of those crazies that still has the tree up, and I'm driving by and I can hear like the robins already coming back and you still have your tree up? Are you one of those psychos? Or are you me where it's like, I have to start the new year without a bunch of shit in my house?
Oh, I think that's going to be me this year.
I like the new year where there's not a ton of clutter. Jen mentioned at the beginning of the podcast that we decorate like crazy outside, but we also decorate the inside of our house like crazy people too. So it's you put up 3 trees.
I mean, it's
insane. But so I'm curious to know because I would imagine a lot of it is based on what you grew up with. Like what it is when you take down decorations, like, because I mean, there's that hot debate of, you know, people are like, you should go to prison if you put a tree up before Thanksgiving. You should go straight to hell. You know, I'm like, calm down. It's a tree. If it makes me happy, it's in my house. I didn't put it up in your house, you wacko. Right. But yeah, I mean, you see the debates on Facebook and everything, like, no Christmas before Thanksgiving. And it's the memes of the turkey beating up Santa because Santa came in too soon. And like, people are pretty pissed about it. So,
right.
You know, like, maybe slow your roll. If it makes you happy, then put them up.
A roll. That sounds tasty right now.
You've not had enough to eat?
I had a salad for lunch. I have not eaten since.
Well, that's why you're hungry.
A few cookies. Okay. But yeah, anyway.
All right. So, yes, leave us your comments on the page, What Won't We Say, on Facebook.
All right. Thanks, and have a good one.
Thank you for listening to What Won't We Say.